There is this thing. Do you realize what is? There is this thing. Do you realize
consciousness is affected?
There is this thing
on.
There is this thing going on.
What
do you realize
our consciousness is affected?
There is this thing going on.
What is called
the news brought to you live.
Hi, welcome back to Unfit to Print. This is CKUT on 90.3 FM, broadcasting not live, but still from Montreal. My name is Amy Lloyd.
I'm Maya Ibbotson.
Today we broadcast from the Jiuzhaige, the traditional territory of the Haudenosaunee and the Anishinaabe Nations.
Today we will be playing three interviews, starting with Natalie from 4R Kids, followed by Greg Mickelson, a former McGill Environmental Studies prof, and lastly, Myrtle and Matt, who are representatives and founders of the Climate Pledge Collective. All these interviews took place after, during, or before last Friday's Fossil Banks No Thanks event. Friday's event was a call to action organized by a variety of organizations demanding Canada's top five banks divest from the fossil fuel industry. We spoke with our guests about greenwashing, Indigenous land sovereignty, and McGill's 2025 Climate Action Plan. We want to issue a content warning as this upcoming segment discusses environmental racism and brief mentions of colonialism. Don't go anywhere. We'll be right back after a short break.
Bye.
That was St. Motel with Sweet Talk, and now it's time for our weekly headline roundup. I thought this headline would be a good segue into today's sustainability-themed feature, as provided by McGill's SSMU updates. Here it is. Did you know that Metro Incorporated is financing and empowering a major supporter of investments in the fossil fuel industry within Canadian universities? Divest McGill and CJM, with the help of SSMU, are calling for a boycott of Metro Inc.'s grocery stores. We are targeting the financial and professional interests of Mary S. Bertrand, Vice Chair of McGill's BOG and board member at Metro. Join us on February 6th to picket in front of a Metro store in Montreal. Details and location to be announced on the Divest McGill Facebook page, or spread the word about the boycott, gather a few of your friends, and organize your own picket at your local Metro grocery store. The organization would like to say that they've always got picket signs and pamphlets to spare.
I want to issue a content warning before this headline as it briefly discusses death. In regards to international news, for 5 months now, demonstrations in India have been going on. Punjabi farmers are protesting the government's 3 farming laws that were enacted back in September. As explained by Global News reporter Emerald Bensadoun, quote, the Indian government has argued the changes will give farmers more freedom, but farmers are concerned the new laws will drive down their product prices with no safeguards to protect them against corporate takeovers and exploitation. They also claim the government did not hold sufficient consultation before signing laws into action. On Saturday, the Modi government suspended mobile internet services, promising the shutdown will go until Sunday. This shutdown took place during a hunger strike held by thousands of farmers in Delhi. According to the BBC, quote, tens of thousands of protesting farmers have been camped out on Delhi's outskirts for more than a month. Talks between unions and the government have failed to break the deadlock. The protests made international headlines on Tuesday when a tractor rally ended in violent clashes. Some demonstrators stormed Delhi's historic Red Fort and occupied it until police pushed them back, unquote. The shutdown was enacted in Singu, Ghazipur, and Tikri, the districts where farmers have gathered.
There's a petition going around for Concordia University to make its Grey Nuns residence into a temporary shelter for the houseless in Montreal. So as we all know, there are a lot of university residents building empty of students due to COVID. There are also some on the McGill campus, but I suppose that's for another time. Rather than leave these spaces empty while hundreds sleep outside in the Montreal winter, we may as well make use of these spaces to house those who don't have a permanent shelter. The petition has a goal of 1,500, but I bet they're going to top it. So go ahead and sign. The link will be in our resource list.
As per usual, it's time for our COVID-19 updates here in Quebec. The province reported 1,223 new COVID-19 cases on Sunday. According to the Montreal Gazette, quote, just 84 vaccine doses were administered in the province on Saturday as Canada continues to deal with supply issues. Quebec has administered 238,227 doses since the start of its vaccination campaign, unquote. Canada has suspended all flights to and from Mexico, along with Caribbean countries, until the 30th of April. Canada now also requires that passengers on flights arriving in Vancouver, Toronto, Montreal, and Calgary be tested for the virus after they have landed. They also will be required to pay upwards of $2,000 and stay in a government-designated hotel from 3 to 14 days. Many self-proclaimed snowbirds, i.e. people who travel to warmer climates during the Canadian winters, are complaining that this precaution to contain the virus and its new, more contagious variant is a ridiculous measure, while others may argue that this is merely a consequence of choosing to travel during a pandemic. On Sunday morning, around 200 members of the Good News Chapel held a protest to demand their right to worship. According to Pastor Stefano Cesudaldi, church is an essential service. This will mark the third Sunday the group has stood outside the church in protest. Places of worship were shut down at the start of January as part of a series of lockdowns around the city to slow the spread of COVID-19. That was our weekly headline roundup. Now it's time for a quick groovy tune and then our audio essay.
Still around, I don't know what to talk about. I'm too precautious and I often doubt how can I be the
Welcome back to Unfit to Print. That was Jelani Array with Stella Brown.
Now it's time for our segment on Fossil Banks No Thanks. So as we mentioned earlier, we will be playing three interviews, starting with Natalie from For Our Kids, followed by Greg Mickelson, and lastly with Myrtle and Matt, who are from the Climate Pledge Collective. All of these interviews took place after, during, or before last Friday's Fossil Banks No Thanks event, which was created as a call to action and demanded for Canada's top five banks to divest from the fossil fuel industry. So we spoke to our guests about greenwashing, Indigenous land sovereignty, and McGill's 2025 climate action plan, and we want to issue a content warning as this upcoming segment discusses environmental racism and brief mentions of colonialism. But without further ado, here it is. We hope you enjoy. This past week, across Canada, demonstrators gathered to protest against Canadian banks such as TD and RBC for their participation in and funding towards the fossil fuel industry. This event, titled Fossil Banks No Thanks, was pulled together by various climate activist groups across the nation who want the public to know that Canada's top five banks have financed over $610 billion worth of fossil fuel projects since 2016 alone. Furthermore, this day was meant to bring awareness to Indigenous rights across the country and how unceded land is often exploited through proposed fossil fuel projects. We were grateful enough to be informed of this day from Gregory Mickelson, a friend of the show. Last year, I interviewed Greg, who resigned from his tenureship at McGill as an environmental studies professor in protest of the university's refusal to divest from fossil fuels. That was a really great interview, and you can find it on Apple Podcasts and in the CKUT archives. Today, however, Greg joins us again to discuss with us Fossil Banks No Thanks, the sociopolitical issues surrounding climate activism, and McGill's new climate and sustainability strategy. Just some brief background info on McGill's climate policy. Last year, as mentioned earlier, McGill refused for the third time since 2013 to divest from their fossil fuel investments. About 8.7% of McGill's $1.7 billion investment pool is invested in the energy sector or fossil fuels. Despite student and staff protests, McGill said divestment would be too large a financial risk for the institution to take. Since then, McGill has unveiled its climate and sustainability strategy for 2020 to 2025, which has three main long-term targets. Quote, attaining a platinum sustainability rating by 2030, becoming zero waste by 2035, and achieving carbon neutrality by 2040, unquote. This strategy involves educational, landscaping, waste management, and community building measures, amongst others, to ensure that the university's goals are met. You can learn more about it in the link that we'll provide in the resource list, but we thought we should provide a brief primer for what we discussed in this interview. Besides our interview with Greg, we were lucky enough to have three other climate activists for interviews regarding organizational environmentalism and the Fossil Banks No Thanks event. First up, we have Natalie Kane from the 4R Kids Network. She'll discuss more about what 4R Kids does, specifically surrounding awareness raising, climate activism, and Indigenous rights in her interview with Amy, which we'll play now.
So first things first, what does your organization do / what is it about?
So we're a group called 4R Kids Montreal, and we're part of a larger network of grassroots groups across Canada, also called 4R Kids. And we started actually before 4R Kids, the national network, was an organization. We started to meet with families that were on a local Montreal listserv for supporting each other as parents. And we just started to have a conversation about our concerns and worries around the climate crisis, in part spurred by the youth climate strikes that have been super inspiring the last 2 years. And we started meeting as a group called Families for Climate Justice. And then since 4R Kids as a national network formed, we started getting more involved to coordinate our efforts to curb the climate crisis across the country. So, in a nutshell, we're a group of families, mainly parents, but we try to include our kids as much as possible, who range in ages from babies to teenagers, to do climate actions that have impact in lots of different sectors and lots of different ways.
Mm-hmm. And what is your specific role at 4R Kids?
So we're a non-hierarchical organization, but we do recognize that roles are helpful for organizing and being effective. So I am essentially a volunteer, but a volunteer coordinator for the 4R Kids Montreal group.
Mm-hmm. And obviously this interview is sort of before the January 29th Fossil Banks No Thanks event. So how is 4R Kids involved with that event?
Yeah, well, like a lot of our projects, it's sort of comes from the ground up and conversations with other grassroots organizations and communities. So some of our members heard about the Fossil Banks No Thanks event and Climate Pledge, which is the organization coordinating this day of action, and heard that they were going to be running a campaign to try to pressure the financial sector and Canadian banks in particular to stop using clients' money, all of our money, to invest in fossil fuels. So some of our members heard about this, and then other groups across Canada, the National Network, also were engaged in listening to Climate Pledge's plans, through email lists and having some meetings and, you know, the sort of behind-the-scenes networking work that makes movement strong. So we heard about the event, and then our group early on, our Montreal local team, wanted to do an action to participate, and then for our Kids National, our larger network, got on board to partner with Climate Pledge to make sure that there were groups of parents across Canada also partaking in this day of action on the 29th. So we've been following closely and trying to, one of the success stories is it's not always up to us to come up with the action and lead it and create all the materials. It's also important that we support each other and other movements and organizations that are coming up with cool tactics that are effective. So our group is just trying to stay plugged into what Climate Pledge is offering us, and we plan to visit some bank locations this weekend to deliver some letters about our concerns about where our money is being invested and the big, the big push around this whole action is to also say that banks don't clean up their money out of fossil fuels. Then we plan to take our business elsewhere and go to credit unions or other financial institutions that are doing better in terms of climate policy and divesting from fossil fuels.
What does activism and awareness raising look like in a pandemic? How are you dealing with mainly virtual interactions, especially when it comes to organizing an event like Fossil Banks No Thanks?
Yeah, it's definitely been challenging, more challenging than usual. In terms of this action, we're trying to respect public health guidelines. Well, we are respecting public health guidelines, and in that, in the past, most of these meetings and pressuring tactics of engaging with bank managers and different staff would have ideally been in person. So now we've just been requesting to have virtual meetings with bank managers and investment specialists. So some of our members have already had those meetings this week and talking about, you know, they have their children's RESPs for their education savings or their mortgages, you know, or different large amounts of money as an adult, and saying, like, I'm going to take this money in my business elsewhere unless you divest from fossil fuels. Mm-hmm. So those meetings are happening virtually. And then, yeah, respecting public health guidelines in that we can, as our democratic right, we can protest. Mm-hmm. So we are going to do some physical visits and delivering letters in person, but again, following public health, so wearing masks, socially distancing from each other, keeping people safe and each other safe is like a top priority. But yeah, organizing and making change is definitely harder when we can't be together as a community. So even just making decisions and talking and having meetings with all that being online, things just take a lot longer. So we are trying to use more tools, online tools like Slack and Google Drive, shared docs and things like that to try to collaborate more effectively online. But it certainly is a challenge for all groups, I think, but ours as well.
Mm-hmm. And like most organizations, you guys use social media platforms to spread your message. Do you find that accounts on these platforms have been hindered or helped in the conversation of environmentalism when considering the spread of misinformation online, especially in regards to climate change?
Yeah, I think we do have a presence on social media, Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. And I think so far for our organizing, I haven't seen, we haven't gotten caught up in the sway of misinformation or a lot of spam or like need to, I guess, correct or like kick people out of social media spaces for misinformation. Like that hasn't happened a lot in our community online. But I certainly know that's happening in the world and is definitely a problem and stirring up other types of more harmful movements that are based on fear or like lack of actual facts. I don't think it's been had a huge impact on our organizing work. We tend to, as parents who are, I'd say we're not super young and savvy with social media. A lot of our organizing is happening in a private Facebook group that you need to also like request to join, which, you know, everyone's free to join, but we're trying to eliminate spam or people that are there to create disharmony or like take away from our goal. So we've been able, I think, to shield ourselves a little bit from that and just talk to each other as a community. Like it's a few hundred people, so like a large online community. We don't necessarily know each other all personally, but it's so far been okay.
Environmental activism has been a movement started by and inherent to Indigenous people of Canada and the variety of Indigenous actors that encompass the Indigenous experience. How do you incorporate Indigenous activism into your organization, as well as events like Fossil Banks No Thanks?
Yeah, we definitely recognize and know that, especially, I guess, around climate activism globally, but also here in Canada or Turtle Island, that most of that movement has been led from frontline communities, many of them Indigenous communities that alarm about the tar sands way before it was an issue in the environmental movement or on the radar of larger environmental groups, for example. So I think what we try to do is educate ourselves, as mainly we have no members in our group that are Indigenous, so as mainly white settler activists, part of our job is also to educate ourselves and understand that history better and recognize where it comes from and the leadership from Indigenous communities to inherently protect the land. So, just doing as much self-education as possible. And I guess also someone who's been doing activism for a while, there are new people always that come to our movement and into our groups. So I think part of our role is to mentor people that maybe don't know that history and try to help educate the part of the population that we get to, you know, organize and interact with and welcome them to the movement and help them understand. And in terms of the, you know, practically what that can mean aside from self-education is making sure that we're including Indigenous rights and Indigenous sovereignty in our campaigns and our actions. For Fossil Banks, No Thanks, that includes, along with, like, a more formal letter of what we're asking banks to do to divest. Our chapter in Montreal here has been collaborating with Extinction Rebellion and some other local groups that provided a letter that's written by a coalition of Indigenous leadership and Indigenous-led organizations that also has quite a long background on why Indigenous communities have been fighting this fight for so long. Mm-hmm. So we plan on including that in our delivery with the other letter that talks a little bit more about our personal demands as clients. But we feel like it's important to make sure institutions and corporations like our banks understand that history also and respect Indigenous rights, which are often infringed upon in Canada.
And going off of that point, some Indigenous activists prefer the term land defender, which to me is sort of a demonstration of the important role language plays in activism. So how does For Our Kids utilize language respectively and effectively when discussing climate change in the context of both activism and event planning?
Yeah, I mean, this goes kind of along the lines of my last answer about, like, educating ourselves, but I think it's really important to pay attention and listen to the ways, the names that people want to be called and how to identify themselves and not get too influenced or mistaken by the way mainstream media can sometimes portray different people in the movement, including Indigenous land defenders, like by calling them protesters or using different terms that they haven't called themselves. Mm-hmm. And there's a big difference to from a protester, like protesting like this isn't fair to me, to someone who has inherent land rights, who's defending their sovereign nation from activities of the Canadian state. So we saw that with the protests happening in the West Coast last year with land defenders asserting their land rights but being called different types of adjectives that they, kept denying but kept getting perpetuated in the media, for example. So I think it's important to listen to what people are calling themselves and try to use the terms and names in a respectful way that reflects what they're saying and who they are, just as we don't want to be mischaracterized or misnamed for anything we do. So, yeah, I think language is definitely important. We have to do our best to listen and reflect it. I also think, we also have to be open and forgiving of people when they make mistakes and help them learn why it's important to listen and reflect the names that people want, the terms and language and names people want to have used. Mm-hmm. But I think often we get in our activist circles and groups and activist movements, we are very specific and strict about the language we use and terms, and it can also be really overwhelming for someone who's new to that. So I think we also have a role to play as mentors to help get people to be sensitive to those things and learn them over time too.
Mm-hmm. And lastly, how can people get involved with For Our Kids?
Yeah, so we, as I said at the start, we are like mainly a group of parents and grandparents. In our Montreal group, we also do have some of our kids and young people, and we try to collaborate with different youth organizations and movements as well to make sure we're acting in solidarity. So you don't actually even have to be a member, but just if you think there's a collaboration opportunity or you need support with something or the campaign or an idea, you can get in touch with us. The best way, I would say, is to go to the National Network's website, which is for our kids.ca. On that website, you can also look at all the teams across Canada, including finding links to the Montreal website and all of our social media accounts. And we would welcome people to join our Facebook group, listen for upcoming meetings, or you can also email us at pournosenfantsmtl@gmail.com. If there's any ideas of how we could collaborate or if you want to get involved. And our social media accounts are all using the handle @ForOurKidsMTL.
Now we have our interview with Greg Mickelson, a formerly tenured professor of biology and environmental ethics at McGill University. Amy chatted with him about Fossil Banks No Thanks, which he kindly brought to our attention, as well as political and institutional greenwashing. Here's the interview.
So last time we interviewed you, you just announced your resignation as a tenured professor over McGill's decision not to divest. How have you been since then, and what have you been up to?
I've been very well, thank you. In a nutshell, I have been homeschooling my kids because the pandemic hit basically a month and a half after I quit McGill. I've continued to do research and writing, and also a fair bit of guest lecturing. And then I've also been getting more involved in environmental activism because, you know, there's a mass extinction underway, not to mention catastrophic global warming. And so I've been working with a particular conservation organization in Vermont and Extinction Rebellion in Quebec on those things. So in a nutshell, that's what I've been up to.
You brought to our awareness the January 29th National Day of Action targeting Canada's top five banks so that they stop financing fossil fuel projects. Do you mind further explaining Canadian banks' involvement in the fossil fuel industry and what divestment would mean for those banks and what it would mean for the country?
Yeah, so Canada's biggest five banks, and especially RBC, have given hundreds of billions of dollars in financing to the fossil fuel industry just since the Paris Agreement of 2015, when the world was supposed to be turning in the opposite direction. And divestment would mean basically an end of this financing, you know, stop this, you know, counterproductive kind of move. It would mean an end to driving the economy and ecosystem in exactly the wrong direction by financing new fossil fuel infrastructure when the world already has enough such infrastructure to spell global climate disaster. It would mean their fossil projects would no longer poison the water, violate Indigenous land rights, or spread COVID across this continent. And we see this across Canada and the United States. So, for example, the Canadian banks have heavily financed the Coastal GasLink that TC Energy is forcing through Wet'suwet'en Land in British Columbia. The Canadian government, of course, is forcing the Trans Mountain through Sequoia Land, also in BC. But also in the U.S., Enbridge is forcing Line 3, another tar sands pipeline, through Anishinaabe Land in Minnesota. And this, in turn, is forcing Indigenous land defenders and their allies to put their own bodies in the way of these planet-crushing projects. But one aspect that's not quite as well known is that divestment from the fossil fuel industry would actually create jobs, because that money would be invested in something else. And when you invest in just about any other industry besides the fossil fuel industry, you create more jobs per dollar invested. And so basically, to sum up, RBC's fossilized finances are bad for the Earth, bad for North America, and bad for Canada. It's time for them to quit, or for us to quit RBC, which is the name of a fairly new campaign by Extinction Rebellion Quebec.
And going off of January 29th, so today was the Fossil Banks No Thanks event. From your perspective as a virtual participant, how do you think the event went?
Yeah, well, my impression is that it went very well. I've been in communication with some of the people who were, you know, physically involved in, taking all the COVID precautions, but going to branches of RBC and other banks, and people did different things around the country. What Extinction Rebellion Quebec did in Montreal was they conveyed a letter by a bunch of Indigenous women land defenders to the CEOs of all the major banks, begging them to stop, financing these destructive projects. So they conveyed that letter to the branch managers, as well as a letter of our own, kind of explaining what we want them to do and why they have to do it pretty quickly. So I think the event was quite successful. It's gotten some press coverage. I guess some of my favorite highlights, viewing it from afar, involved a character called Leo the Lion, who went to a few RBC branches in Montreal and kind of lightened things up a little bit, but also, I think, conveyed the seriousness of the message at the same time.
And Canada, as a country, has sort of continuously branded itself as a country that is affiliated with the outdoors and environmentalism. Though we advertise our country's forests, mountains, and green advocacy in general, events like Fossil Banks No Thanks show that Canada's activism is at least partially performative. Could you tell us more about this political environmentalism that we see in our country?
Yeah, I mean, I think you're right. I think there is too much political posturing and too little effective action. So, for example, we've not only let the ruling class turn our country into a thuggish petrostate, but we've also let them turn our managed forests from carbon sinks. So we think of forests as being a good thing for, for the climate and for the environment, and they are in their natural state, or when they're managed in the right way. But it turns out that Canada's forests are now being logged so heavily that they're turning into carbon sinks. They're liberating more carbon than they're able to take in. So yeah, I think there are lots of examples of that, and we really need to turn around and start doing the right thing.
And with the rise of populism and other affiliated political movement, the internet has allowed and even encouraged the spread of misinformation. We've definitely been seeing that a lot during the pandemic, and this is especially evident when it comes to climate change and its denial. How have you seen the internet and social media negatively contribute to environmentalism and awareness?
Yeah, well, I'm certainly no expert on social media, but it does seem to have fueled the rise of the most anti-environmental U.S. president in recent history. And that's saying a lot, because U.S. presidents are not very environmentally responsible in general. But I would say that Trump had the additional unfortunate effect of making Trudeau look good by comparison, despite such idiotic and ecocidal moves as paying billions of our tax dollars for the failing Trans Mountain pipeline. So yeah, like I said, I'm not an expert, but I think it's true, and I certainly don't know what to do about it. I mean, it's great to have platforms where people can share ideas, but it obviously has some very scary aspects, and we need to learn how to deal with those.
And lastly, as you emailed us the Le Daily article on McGill's new climate action plan, they recently unveiled it. It's like supposed to be accomplished by the year 2025. However, when you go on the website and you look at its content, it seems pretty vague. This brings forth the question as to whether this is yet another ploy of performative activism on McGill's behalf, considering the fact that they won't divest in the first place. What do you think about the situation / will this action plan outweigh McGill's investment in fossil fuels?
Well, it certainly won't outweigh McGill's investment in fossil fuel. And the reason is that Canada is actually contributing far more to global climate disaster through its production of fossil fuel than it is through its consumption, even though our consumption is also way too high on a kind of global comparative level. We actually pull twice as much fossil fuel per capita as the U.S. Out of the ground. And given that, as important as it is for Canadian institutions like McGill to reduce their fossil fuel consumption, it is even more important for them to turn away from fossil fuel production, i.e. divest. 190 other institutions of higher learning have already beat them to it. It's time for them to finally come around. I think it's probably worth taking a close look at that plan. I've glanced over it a little bit, and one thing to maybe pay attention to is the different categories of emissions that McGill says it's going to bring down to zero by 2040, because that's all part of the plan. And there's this kind of standard classification of scope 1, scope 2, and scope 3 emissions. And only one of those has been decreasing at McGill. The other two have been going up. And so, you know, are they really serious even about bringing overall consumption down? I know there are a lot of particular people at McGill who are serious about it and committed to it. But you're right, it's easy to be cynical about the you know, higher administration and the board, who are often attracted to greenwashing measures as much as to real, you know, real effective steps.
Lastly, we have Matt Lee Paelke and Myrtle Millaris, who run the Climate Pledge Collective. Their volunteer-run organization provides pledgers and bank switch initiatives to advocate for less fossil fuel investment individually and institutionally. Amy talked more about this, as well as the Fossil Banks No Thanks event and proposed energy projects like the Keystone XL pipeline in their interview, which we will play now.
So firstly, would you mind telling our listeners what your organization does what is it about?
Climate Pledge Collective is a small organization. What we try to do is sort of build tools that make it easy for anyone to get involved in climate activism, stuff you can do from home, maybe stuff you can do in any sort of neighborhood. So the first thing we did was a pledge, which gives a lot of options. Some of it's getting involved in politics, some of it's reducing your own personal footprint, just to give people a lot of ideas of what they can do. And then from that, we've built other tools and organized things like climate picnics, both in Toronto and in Ottawa. So, yeah, we just try to make things that are accessible to people who might be new to activism, but that will hopefully have an impact on global emissions.
And what are your roles at Climate Pledge Collective?
So we founded the organization. So it came out actually of Matt's worry about climate change, and obviously, so the pledge idea came out of his discussions with a few friends of his that were equally concerned. So we decided to start Climate Pledge Collective because we felt like we needed to give it a name online, and then it snowballed from there. So as far as our roles, we both sync up campaigns. So we haven't really divided things so much, but what's ended up happening, I guess, is depending on the project, we will outreach to various people or communities, and we will just kind of take turns doing that. We also run the social media channels sort of separately. I do the Instagram, he does Twitter, and we do Facebook together. And I tend to do the finances. I also run all music teaching studios in terms of the business aspect.
Thing is, we get a lot of help with individual projects from volunteers or people we've connected with on social media, but kind of the two of us, I guess, design the campaigns and do a lot of the, like, infrastructure stuff for the group, sending out the emails and all of that kind of thing.
And how was Climate Pledge Collective involved with January 29th Fossil Banks No Thanks event, and how do you guys think it went?
Well, we think it went really well. In terms of our involvement, it was one of those, I guess, collective ideas from a lot of people, but sort of we were running our webinars on BankSwitch, and we ran one for the For Our Kids group, and some of the members from For Our Kids were interested in doing more than just sending the letter, but doing something in person. And then that got going, and people started talking about that, an in-person day of action. And then a lot of other groups joined in with that, Extinction Rebellion Montreal, a lot of the 350 groups, Toronto 350, Ottawa 350, Vancouver 350. And so we all sort of were involved in planning it. Unfortunately, because of COVID, a lot of it became sort of mostly digital. But there was still sort of postering and banners and all of that kind of thing. So, yeah, we were involved in sort of the early discussions and a lot of the digital stuff. And I put up a few posters in our neighborhood. But, yeah.
I think given that it wasn't in real life, I guess the attention that it gathered was pretty good on social media. And the few actions that did happen outdoors, I think, were very effective. Like there was a Toronto 350 banner drop over one of the main highways. So, you know, some visibility like that is great. And they put eviction notices up on bank windows as well. So I think there was discussion generated in real life and online.
So going off of that, as you mentioned, Climate Pledge Collective has a project named BankSwitch. Would you mind explaining to our listeners what the project is, as well as its potential impact on the climate change movement?
Wow, I don't know if it'll have an impact on the whole climate change movement, but I can explain the campaign and what our goals are with it. So I guess it is building off a lot of previous campaigns. There have been other campaigns that sort of worked to pressure the banks sort of by giving negative publicity. A lot of protests, like the Fossil Bank No Thanks, this year and in the past, there's been similar ones. And there's also been projects. There was one called Grow the Record out in British Columbia to try to get people to switch to credit unions. So we're trying to combine the two of those ideas. And what we're asking people to do is to contact their bank, especially their branch manager, or if they have a financial advisor who knows them already, to contact them and say that you're worried about the bank's fossil fuel policies, and that you're going to move to whichever bank is the most sustainable in April. We designed it that way because I think it gives a little more leverage, because once you're still a customer, the bank will handle your request a little bit differently than if you'd left. So if you leave and go to a credit union, I do think that's good, but the bank will sort of move on and forget about it fairly quickly. But if you have that couple of months where you're still thinking about being a customer and you're just raising the issue as much as possible, I think that's when you have the maximum pressure on the bank. So we're asking everyone to reach out and say to their banks that it's not okay that you're still making all these new big loans to fossil fuels, and that I don't feel comfortable banking with you anymore, and that I'm looking around and I'm looking carefully at all the banks and the credit unions, of course, their policies on fossil fuels.
And while we're on the conversation of banks in general, there is an evident tie between the fossil fuel industry and large corporations benefiting from its wealth. How does the economic agendas of certain financial institutions lobby to undermine the fight for climate advocacy?
Yeah, I think one of the reasons we picked this campaign is because I think really the banks right now are kind of a linchpin that's slowing everything down. I thought a lot about why the Liberals haven't been more aggressive with their policies, why they're building a pipeline. I mean, they're still not getting any votes in Alberta and in a lot of the prairie provinces. So there must be some other impetus behind that. And I think part of the problem is that our Canadian banks are overinvested in the tar sands, and that if the tar sands stop expanding, the banks are going to take a hit on their profits as well. And that they have the ear of the Liberals, and they're trying to pass on this message that the Liberals seem to try to do, that is like, we'll take climate action and we'll also expand fossil fuels, which is just contradictory and doesn't make any sense. So our hope is that if we can pressure the banks to get out of their position on all these loans, that it'll also move forward sort of all the other climate policies that we need in this country.
And to add on to that point, a lot of fossil fuel projects, such as the proposed Keystone XL pipeline, are often extremely detrimental, not only to the you know, general environment, but to Indigenous land, specifically as proposed projects often run through unceded territory. How do you ensure that the reality of environmental racism is incorporated in and emphasized throughout your organization's activism?
Yeah, so obviously it's such a huge entangled problem. It's going to require a lot of work undoing this. I mean, it's centuries. And so in terms of how it's, I guess, incorporated, I feel like for me, like, I was born in the Philippines, and I had learned very early on that, you know, my country was rich in resources and that companies were coming to the Philippines because of that. So it wasn't quite framed in the light of they're taking our stuff. But that's essentially what happened. So rivers have become polluted, the air itself. So that in that sense, it's really, I guess for me, I resonate very deeply with that. So I feel like anything we do has that aspect as part of it, as a result. Even bank switch. Like, obviously, we're paying, essentially, every single one of us who accesses banking services is contributing to this collective purse that's just destroying land, not just here, but across the globe. And its impact is immediate, it's now, and it's going to last for a long time. So how do we emphasize this? Well, very recently in our Bank Switch webinars, like, we do a land acknowledgement, but also make sure that it's connected to the issues that are happening currently, and also just reminding people about what I just spoke about, the power of our money to contribute to that destruction of people. Like, sometimes we talk about the numbers of emissions, money that's been going into funding, and the people aspect of it is lost in the figures. So it's really important to make that connection. And, you know, any chance we get, really, to make that connection on social media even, and, you know, I mean, sitting there on your phone doesn't do very much, but we're hoping that constantly reminding people of that issue is very important. So certainly when we get a chance to speak about it. So I really hope that helps. Ensuring that in each person is very difficult, but hopefully over time, and I'm hearing more voices speaking up about that, I'm really hoping that, you know, that gets change happening, not just here, but, you know, across traditional Indigenous lands all over.
And what are some Climate Pledge collective resources you could offer our listeners?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a variety of things you can do. They're all on our website, climatepledgecollective.org. The thing we're most focused on right now is this bank switch campaign. So you can go there and you can read about how the campaign works. There's talking points if you end up booking an appointment with your bank. There's letter templates. And there's a sign-up as well that we have through Action Network, because we're trying to track how many people are signed up, because I think that might help us get some media attention on the issue. And it also sends a message to the banks that, you know, a small grassroots organization was able to get hundreds, hopefully eventually thousands of people signed up to talk to their banks about this issue. It shows the banks that there's even more people out there who would like to see them clean up their act on this issue, but maybe haven't heard about Climate Pledge Collective, or they it's a bit too much hassle for them to move their bank accounts, but that this is an important thing to not just a small number of activists, but to, like, a broad variety of Canadians. So we do need people to come to the website and sign up for the campaign. I think it helps grow the campaign and makes it more meaningful to the banks as well.
We also have other resources as far as just, like, getting to know what the issues are with regard to the climate crisis. So we have a set of slides with facts in it if people wanted to know what the lay of the land is, so to speak, right now. It was also translated for us by someone in Spanish, so it's also available in that language now. So on our website, we have a whole host of resources, including an educator's resource kit that was written by a couple of teachers. So, yeah, there's just a lot in there right now, I think, that people could look at, no matter what level of acquaintance they might have.
And lastly, how can people get involved with Climate Change Pledge Collective?
Yeah, I mean, I think we try to design things so that the tools let people take it to the level that they want. So, like, the bank campaign, you can sign up and talk to your branch manager, but you can also print posters. You can put posters up at some of the nearby branches We try to design most of our campaigns like that. So I think the first thing is to just go to the website, see what some of the things we are doing are, maybe sign up for an email newsletter, and then get in touch with us. Like, we're really open-minded about ideas. We take ideas from people that want to work on something, we'll advance a project, or there are ways to get involved. Like, for the Bank Switch campaign, one of the next things we want to do is what's called block recruiting, where we'd maybe try to go to small organizations, social enterprises, churches, and get them to switch their bank accounts, and then send out a message to all of the people who were involved in that church or social enterprise about what they did and why. So we would love to have people right now who maybe you run an organization or you're a regular member of your church or something, to get in touch with us about moving organizations and coming at the banks from that slightly different angle.
So when you sign up for the newsletters, there's a checkbox for volunteer information. So if that's something that people are particularly interested in, then that's something available to them.
All right, so that concludes all of our interviews. We hope you guys enjoyed them. As per usual, we have our resource list, which I'll just read out quickly right now. First up, we have the Climate Pledge Collective Organization's website, which, as mentioned in the interview, is a volunteer-run organization. The website specifically provides templates for the Bank Switch initiatives, which Amy talked about, as well as individual pledges to take away support for fossil fuel investment. Next, we have the For Our Kids organization, again mentioned by Natalie in the interview. For Our Kids is an organization spreading awareness about climate change across Canada with the kind of slogan to improve the earth and the environment for generations to come. Next, we have the link for McGill's climate and sustainability strategy for 2020 to 2025. And this is just a homepage outlining McGill's proposed short-term and long-term actions for the university's environmental policy. This includes FAQ, strategy categories, a video, and contact information if you want to check that out. Next, we have Divestment McGill. On the kind of flip side of that coin, we have just a link to Divest McGill, which is a student-run initiative for the school to divest from their fossil fuel investments. The website shares helpful resources, ways to get involved, demonstrations, and they also have all of their socials on the website, which are good to follow. Lastly, we have Indigenous Climate Action Organization, which is a website by and for Indigenous climate activists, and it includes a blog, news about climate initiatives, and ways to take action. All right, folks, that concludes our segment for the day. We hope you enjoyed our mini series of interviews. We know it's been a while since we've had a chance to have an interview or multiple on the show. We're super excited that we got to talk to so many important people today, and stay tuned because we will be right back after a few songs. You're listening to Unfit to Print on CKUT 90.3 FM.
Thanks for tuning in this week for Unfit. Much appreciated. Come back next week at the same time for another show. We want to thank Natalie, Greg, Myrtle, and Matt for coming on our show today. We appreciate you folks sharing your input and expertise with us. Special thanks to Gregory Mickelson, who was instrumental in creating and organizing this week's feature. Playing us out, we have Frances Forever with Space Girl.
Si angiliubunga ulume maji 2 2021 tunga sugit tinipubukkunnu majiit mulakangakubasutakatakbut ang naipidjutigilugit ilisaksivaklutalu ang naipanulong ninginni. Ullumi ang naipidjutigilugit ang nangni nipilogisimabugut. Ukakatakakabunga Angela amagwarinmit ingyutilanganit sa nakatakanginniklu. Jennifer May ukakatakakbuk kaila mikomit. Pilagakatakdanga iminit nagligiklu nukakik. Pikugusutakakatakdilugit ang nakatimingit magpukuni innang nilu. Tusang naktiktinakbukut inuktoktinit nalagitli. I'm Nancy Angilak. Today is March 2nd, 2021, and welcome to Nipibut. On March 8th, each year we celebrate International Women's Day to recognize the achievements of women. Today, in honor of International Women's Day, we interview influential Inuit women. I speak with Angela Amagwalik about